Hi, this is Steve Carroll, and you're listening to EM Basic. Today, we're going to talk about one of the most common yet possibly serious complaints that we face every day, chest pain. This complaint has a myriad of possible causes for it, and we are the front line of medicine as far as diagnosing all these possible serious causes. Just about anyone who shows up to any outpatient office with chest pain will get referred our way for further workup, so we need to be good at this. First off, I am obligated to say that this podcast doesn't represent the views or opinions of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or my residency program. With that out of the way, let's start with one of the most broad and vexing topics in emergency medicine, chest pain. So first off, you're going to pick up the chart, read the triage note, make sure to look at their vital signs, and look at the EKG. So for the vast majority of patients, the EKG will already be on the chart. So you want to ask yourself one question real quick. First of all, is this a STEMI? So you want to start looking at their anatomical locations. You want to look at, I like to look at them in certain groups. So look at 1 in AVL, 2, 3 in AVF, V1 through V3, and V4 to V6. And make sure not to neglect AVR. So let's go over this one more time. So 1 in AVL is your lateral leads. 2 and 3 AVF is your inferior leads. V1 to V3 is your anterior septal leads. And V4 to V6 is your lateral leads. So then you want to do some sort of systematic approach. So I use this Dubin's method, which is look at their rate, rhythm, axis, intervals, and look for signs of ischemia. Now, I'm not going to go over all these things, but, you know, the big things are, you know, what's their rate? Are they in sinus rhythm or not sinus rhythm? They have major axis deviation, and make sure to address all their important intervals. Their PR, their QRS, their QT intervals are the most important ones. Next, you want to look for any flip T waves. These can be signs of ischemia. You want to look for any elevations that you may see. These can be signs of infarction, whereas any depressions in your ST segment can be ischemia or infarction opposite of that lead that you're looking at. So after you've interpreted the EKG, you want to look at the computer's interpretation and reconcile it with your own interpretation. So then you want to go on and ask for the patient's history. So I like the OPQRST mnemonic that I think we've all learned. I'll go over this real quick. So onset is when did the symptoms start. Provocation, so what makes your pain better, if anything. Quality, what does it feel like? So if the patient can't describe it, you want to offer them adjectives like sharp, dull, pressure. You want to give them a kind of a multiple choice list if they can't figure out a word to describe it. One thing I will say is that people will say, well, it's not pain, but it's pressure. Just let them know that you mean the same, that pressure is the same thing as pain. So then relieving factors, what makes your pain better or worse? What makes your pain worse? If anything, ask about over-the-counter and medication use. Severity, so on a 1 to 10 scale, how bad is your pain? This is to monitor their response to treatment. And time, when did your pain start? Often, the most important question that I think we neglect is, what exactly were you doing when your pain started? Were you at rest? Were you walking around? Were you doing strenuous activity? Or did you just get stabbed in the chest? So you want to ask these questions. So the big important questions are also the associated signs or symptoms. Do you have nausea, vomiting, diaphoresis, abdominal or back pain, near syncope or syncope? So this really helps guide your differential. Also ask, have you ever had this pain before? If they have a cardiac history, how does this pain compare to their last event? You know, how does this compare to your last MI or the last time you had to have stents placed? Past history, you want to ask them for a history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, MI or CHF. These risk factors are not really helpful to you, but the cardiologists really want to know them up front. Bonus points if you can have a recent discharge summary with a recent echo with an ejection fraction, because the cardiologists will really like to know this. You also want to ask them if you ever had a catheterization or a stress test. So usually you tell people, have you ever run on a treadmill or have they ever stuck a needle into your groin? Usually people can remember that. If possible, you want to confirm the results of their cath or stress test with their medical record. A negative cath may still have a 30% clot in their OID that can cause a future thrombosis in MI. However, do not let a recent cath or stress test dissuade you from a workup. Medications. You want to focus on their blood pressure meds, their hyperlipidemia meds, aspirin, Plavix, Coumadin, or the new anticoagulant called Bradaxa. So real quick, You want to go over their EKG, look at the anatomical locations, look for any flip T waves, elevations or depressions. Make sure to interpret it on your own, but then make sure that you don't you look at the computer's interpretation and reconcile it with your own. Then ask your history things, onset, provocation, quality, relieving, severity, time. That's your OPQRST. Ask them what they were doing when their pain started, their associated symptoms. Have they ever had this pain before? Their past history, focusing on cardiac issues. Have they ever had a catheterization or a stress test? And then their medications, focusing on their blood pressure meds, aspirin, hyperlipidemia, anticoagulants, things like that. So let's go on to the differential diagnosis of chest pain. So we can talk all day about the differential diagnosis. However, there are six deadly causes of chest pain that you must at least consider in each patient. So the mnemonic for this is remember you take your pet Mac for a walk. Trust me, this works. So the mnemonic is PETMAC. So this stands for P is for PE, E is for esophageal rupture, T is for tension pneumothorax, M is for MI, A is for aortic dissection, and C is for cardiac tamponade. So let's go over that one more time. PET MAC, that's PE, esophageal rupture, tension pneumothorax, MI, aortic dissection, and cardiac tamponade. So this does not mean that every 20-year-old with chest pain needs a CT of their aorta for a dissection. However, you must at least consider these possibilities in every patient with chest pain. So let's go on to their physical exam. First of all, just answer their question. Answer one question. What's their volume status? Do they look volume down? Do they look volume up? Or do you think they're euvolemic? So this is really important in patients that have CHF as a past medical history, because you want to see if they're volume up or not. So you want to pay close attention to their heart and lung sounds. You want to make sure they have really listen for any murmurs. Check to see if they radiate. Probably the murmur we care about the most is aortic stenosis in the emergency room. So make sure that you check to see if the murmur radiates their carotids or not. From there, you should also press on the patient's chest wall to see if you can reproduce their chest pain, but do so with caution. So if this is a young person with chest pain that you think is musculoskeletal, then the fact that it reproduces their pain is a helpful finding. But if it's a 50-year-old diabetic female with a good story for MI, then you may not want to really go there, because about 20% of patients with a diagnosed MI will have reproducible chest pain. So report this finding on your chart and your attending with caution. Also, don't neglect an abdominal exam and a back exam. You'll be very sheepish if you miss that AAA that has a bounding abdominal pulse because you neglected to palpate their abdomen. Then you want to check their legs for edema or swelling. Is one calf more swollen than the other, suggesting a DVT? So is the edema pitting or non-pitting? So pitting edema is compressible. You press it in with your thumb and it stays compressed. This suggests volume overload and capillary leak. Or is it non-pitting edema? This is not compressible. This doesn't form an indentation when you press on it. This suggests generally another cause for edema, such as a DVT. Check pulses, especially to make sure they're symmetric. A pulse deficit can suggest an aortic dissection, although not having a pulse deficit doesn't rule out an aortic dissection. So real quick physical exam, look at their volume status, listen to their heart and lungs, check for any murmurs, especially aortic stenosis. Press on the patient's chest wall, but realize that a decent portion of people with MI will have reproducible chest pain. Make sure to do an abdominal exam and back exam, and then check their legs for edema or swelling, and make sure to check their pulses at their radials, and for completeness sake, if their dorsalis pedis as well. So let's go on to the workup for chest pain. So here's the bottom line. Every patient with chest pain needs an EKG and chest x-ray. The EKG screens for arrhythmia and coronary artery disease, and the chest x-ray screens for esophageal rupture, pneumothorax, and to a lesser extent, aortic dissection. Not everyone needs a massive workup for their chest pain. Everyone does need an EKG and chest x-ray. Beyond that, your workup is guided by their age, their risk factors, and their presentation. So in the EKG, as far as young person considerations, be careful to make sure that this chest pain isn't a syncope component, because if they have syncope along with their chest pain, this is a much different route and something we're not really going to be talking about today, but you need to look for different things in their EKG. So as far as general considerations on the patient's EKG, once again, you want to immediately evaluate for ST elevations. If your patient has chest pain and ST elevations of 2 or more millimeters and 2 or more contiguous leads, then they need to go to the cath lab, of course, assuming this isn't a young person with pericarditis that has diffuse ST elevations. But if they have chest pain and two or more millimeters of ST elevation and two or more contiguous leads, then you need to get them to the cath lab. Your workup's done, it's over. They need to go. Yes, they still need a few things before they leave for the cath lab, but we'll talk about that a little later. If you see a left bundle branch pattern that is new or presumed to be new in a patient with chest pain, this is also an indication for the cath lab. However, I'll warn you that this may be changing from an emergent trip to the cath lab to an urgent trip to the cath lab in a few years, but stay tuned. As of right now, if you have a new or presumed new left bundle branch pattern with chest pain, then this is an indication for an immediate catheterization. Also realize that the left bundle branch block pattern makes interpreting for ischemia and infarction much more difficult. If you want more on this, Google Scarbosa's criteria. It's an excellent PIMP question and fodder for rounds. That's spelled S-G-A-R-B-O-S-S-A. Scarbosa. Look hard for ischemic changes. Look for flip T waves or ST elevations or depressions. If something seems abnormal, look to see if the patient has an old EKG to compare it to. If any of the abnormalities are new, this is much more concerning. So let's go on to the chest x-ray. So for most of your chest pain roulette MI, this is just a box to check. However, your suspicion of the patient's diagnosis can help you figure out what you're looking for. So for example, if you have a young, thin smoker who's an asthmatic with a sudden onset of chest pain and shortness of breath, looking for that pneumothorax is important. And that patient who may be febrile with their chest pain, looking for that pneumonia is important. Or if the patient has crackles and may be volume overloaded, then it's nice to confirm your suspicion of pulmonary edema by seeing wet lungs on the chest x-ray. Although chest x-ray is a reasonable screen for aortic dissection, it is not a definitive test. Widening the mediastinum is about 60 to 70% sensitive in the diagnosis of dissection, but in a patient with a low pretest probability is a reasonable screening tool. For the complaints of esophageal rupture, aortic dissection, and cardiac tamponade, these can often reasonably ruled out with a good history. Let's address those three diseases quickly. So first, esophageal rupture. This is also called Boerhaave syndrome. On the x-ray, look for free air under the diaphragm. Do they have peritonitis on their abdominal exam? Do they have a history of recent forceful vomiting? Or did they have a recent endoscopy? Or are they a big alcoholic? These patients usually look sick as stink, but this is a diagnosis with a high mortality rate, so it has to be addressed. Next, aortic dissection. Hypertension is by far the most prevalent risk factor in this disease. After that, other risk factors include pregnancy and connective tissue diseases such as Marfan's and Ehlers-Danlos. Most classically, this is described as ripping or tearing pain in someone's chest that radiates to the back. People talk about unequal BPs between left and right arms, but these are unreliable at best. If present, you are generally looking for a difference of at least 20 millimeters of mercury between the two arms. Anything less than that is not significant. Furthermore, BP changes are only about 60 to 70% sensitive for the disease. In a young person with chest pain, make sure that they don't appear Marfanoid, with long, slender fingers and a very thin and tall build, or have signs of Ehlers-Danlos, such as hyperflexible joints. A real peripheral aortic dissection is that if you have chest pain plus a motor or neuro deficit, or you have chest pain and a seemingly unrelated complaint elsewhere in your body, you should consider a dissection since the aorta is the only thing that connects both. Let's say that one more time. So you have chest pain plus a motor or neuro deficits, think of dissection. And if you have chest pain and a seeming unrelated complaint elsewhere in your body, consider a dissection. So the test of choice to rule out dissection is a CT aorta with contrast. If the patient has a diet allergy or has an elevated creatinine, which you can get if the dissection takes out the renal arteries, then you'll need to get a transesophageal echo or cardiac MRI to rule out this serious cause of chest pain. Cardiac tamponade. So classically, this is described as muffled heart sounds, JVD, and hypotension, which is Beck's triad, although these are very late findings and often do not occur altogether. Classically, the pulse pressure is narrow due to the incomplete emptying of the ventricle and diastole. This can easily be ruled out with a bedside ER ultrasound, but it is often unnecessary. Unless the patient has risk factors like cancer, such as a malignant effusion, or they have kidney failure on dialysis, they may have a uremic effusion, or unless they are a trauma patient and you think they have traumatic tamponade, this is one diagnosis that you don't see a lot compared to everything else on your list. So let's go through those one more time. Three causes you can mostly rule out by history is esophageal rupture, Borhoff syndrome. Do they have free air on their chest x-ray or peritonitis on their abdominal exam? Do they have risk factors such as forceful vomiting? Are they an alcoholic or did they get a recent endoscopy? Aortic dissection, hypertension is the biggest risk factor. Other risk factors include pregnancy and connective tissue disorders. So this is classically your ripping or tearing chest pain. Don't rely on unequal BPs or a chest x-ray with a wide mediastinum as these are not completely sensitive for the disease. Keep in mind if you have chest pain plus a motor or neuro deficit elsewhere in your body or you have chest pain plus another complaint elsewhere in your body, think of dissection. Cardiac tamponade, look for some risk factors, you know, for such as cancer or kidney end-stage renal disease or a traumatic tamponade. You can rule it out with an ultrasound at the bedside if you need to. So let's go back to the workup. So from there, we're left with two diagnoses, PE and MI, both of which have entire chapters of in Rosen's and Tintinelli's dedicated to them. So I'm not going to be able to summarize them in a short time we have here. I am going to go over the general treatment and disposition parameters for these two diseases quickly, but I'm going to spend more time on these in later episodes. So let's talk about MI. This disease keeps us in business. It has spawned entire new units of the hospital called chest pain units where we admit low-risk people to make absolutely sure that they don't have an MI. So you have to make the decision whether or not you want to pursue this workup at the start. An attending of mine wisely once said, be liberal with your EKGs but stingy with your enzymes. In general, anyone can get an EKG, but if you get cardiac enzymes, you are virtually committing the patient to admission because one set of enzymes is not enough to rule out MI or ACS. Although I will say that this is being looked at frequently in literature, but however, the current standard of care says, you can't get away with just one set of enzymes for any patient that you think may have MI or ACS. So you have to put the patient's story together. Sharp pain is a little less concerning than pressure. Pain that is brought on or made worse by exertion is worrisome. Pain that has persisted for hours is more worrisome than pain that's fleeting. Classically, the MI pain is in the left side of the chest and radiates to the left arm and jaw, is brought on at rest or is exertional, and is associated with nausea, vomiting, and diaphoresis. So the one thing I'll say, don't blow off a patient who is sweating. That being said, every EM doctor out there has seen a patient whose chief complaint was ear pain or toe pain who was having a STEMI. So a few cautions in the history. Pain that radiates into the right extremity or shoulder is less sensitive for cardiac pain, but is very specific. So if someone says their pain radiates to the right side, you should take it very seriously, even though it's not the quote-unquote classic story for MI. Also, women tend to have fewer classic symptoms and may only be fatigued and weak. This goes double for any diabetic. So be very concerned about your female diabetics. They are set up for an atypical presentation. They may just be a little weak and have some fatigue and some nausea, and that's their presentation for MI. They may have no chest pain whatsoever. So now once you've decided to pursue MI and ACS at diagnosis, here's your general workup. So your general workup is this cardiac set we like to talk about. So this is an EKG, a portable chest x-ray, and then some labs. So a CBC, Chem-10, coags, and cardiac enzymes. Let's go through those labs individually, kind of talk about why we get those individual labs. So a CBC, we're most interested, does the patient have some sort of profound anemia that could be causing their chest pain? A Chem-10, let's look for electrolyte abnormalities. The cardiologists love to replete everyone to a potassium of 4 and a magnesium of 2, although there's really not a lot of evidence for this, but you want to make sure they don't have a big electrolyte abnormality. Coags, these are usually low yield, but if you're going to anticoagulate someone because you're thinking they're having an MI or they're having unstable angina, then you want a baseline set of coags. And then cardiac enzymes. So this usually includes a troponin, but most places include a CKMB, with plus or minus a myoglobin or a BNP. So the troponin, just real quick, we're going to review this. Troponin is elevated within the first 4 to 6 hours of MI and stays elevated for 3 to 5 days, whereas CK is elevated somewhere in the 6 to 8 hour range and then slowly goes down over about 1 to 2 days. So now we've ordered the enzymes and you and your attending have decided that this person is not a one-set rule-out candidate, which we talked about before. Is, you know, some attendings may say it's an option, some may not. You have to go with what you're attending things. So every patient who is admitted for a rule-out MI needs 325 of aspirin unless they have a bona fide allergy or contraindication to aspirin. You also give aspirin to people even if they're on Coumadin. If they've taken a full-strength aspirin in the past 24 hours, you don't need to repeat it. However, they need 325 milligrams of aspirin in the past 24 hours one way or another. So then there's some adjuncts. First of all, nitroglycerin. So there are plenty of ways to skin this cat. I prefer, and my institution advocates, to start with nitroglycerin 0.4 milligrams sublingual every 5 minutes times 3 doses. Hold if the patient is chest pain-free or their systolic is less than 100. Before you give this, you must make sure that your male patients haven't taken any Viagra, Cialis, or Levitra recently. Viagra, Cialis, you want to ask them if they've taken it in the past 24 hours. I'm sorry. If for Viagra or Levitra, you want to ask them if they've taken it in the past 24 hours. For Cialis, it's the past 72 hours. If they've taken these medicines recently and you give them nitro, they're going to bottom out their blood pressure and it's not going to be pretty. Also, make sure that your patients have an IV in place before you give nitro, because even healthy people can pass out from it. But however, if they do this, it's usually fluid responsive. Give them a 500cc normal saline bolus and they do better. Also, make sure you don't see any signs of posterior MI, such as the mirror sign in V1 inferior depressions, because they tend to bottom out their blood pressures with nitro as well. So after you've given sublingual, some people will put nitro paste on, especially if nitroglycerin gets the patient pain-free. However, the teleunits where I work won't accept this. They say it's a titratable drug. I really don't agree, but since my patients can't go upstairs with a nitro patch on, I generally don't do nitro patches. If the patient is still having pain after aspirin and nitro, it is unreasonable to try some morphine. Just make sure to give some Zofran with it to prevent nausea and vomiting. Unless they are in severe pain and writhing on the stretcher, 4 milligrams of IV morphine with 8 milligrams of Zofran tends to work pretty well. My institution has this big thing about going upstairs pain-free. Otherwise, the nursing supervisor makes you put the patient in the cardiac care unit. Your institutions may have similar rules, so you have to follow them. Feel free to titrate up that morphine as needed, but realize that if you think that the patient still looks bad or is having refractory pain, that this may be continuing ischemia. You should get another EKG, look for changes, and consider a nitro drip and admission for unstable angina if you're having a hard time getting the patient pain-free. This is a whole other talk into itself, so I'm not going to go into the spectrum of acute coronary syndromes now. The low-risk, quote-unquote, rule-out ACS patients are by far the bulk of our patients that you admit for chest pain, so that is what I'll continue to talk about. Once you have the patient pain-free, repeat an EKG. Even if they never had pain in the ED, get a second EKG to check for changes while they've been here in the emergency room. Compare both EKGs and see if they have any new T-wave or ST changes or if any morphologies have changed. So now it's time to admit. You will be doing this a lot for chest pain, so here's a quick example of how to talk to a cardiologist. In this case, this is a patient for a low-risk chest pain rule-out. You say to the patient, Hi, this is Dr. Turnenburn in the ED. I have a 40-year-old male with a history of hypertension with no known coronary artery disease who comes in with 3 hours of chest pain at home. It started at rest and persisted for 3 hours. It wasn't exertional or positional. He describes a sharp pain in his chest, 5 out of 10 in severity. No other associated signs or symptoms. Exam is normal. EKG is normal and non-ischemic. Chest x-ray is normal and cardiac enzymes are normal as well. He got a 325 milligram aspirin and 1 sublingual nitro with total relief his pain. Repeat EKG has no changes. I would like to admit him for a low-risk rule-out. This hits on everything a cardiology fellow or attending would want to hear about the patient in order to admit them for a low-risk ACS rule-out. So let's kind of review this one more time. Once you've decided that you're going to work out the patient for MI or ACS, you're going to get your EKG, portable chest x-ray, CBC, Chem-10, coags, and cardiac enzymes. Every patient needs an aspirin 325 milligrams. You can use nitroglycerin. Start with some sublinguals. Make sure to get some hold parameters for systolic less than 100. Make sure your male patients have not taken Viagra, Cialis, or Levitra recently. And make sure you don't think that they have a posterior MI. If they're still having pain after nitroglycerin, it is unreasonable to try some morphine. Just be careful if you think they're having continued pain and refractory pain, that they may be having unstable angina, and that's a whole different story. Once you get the patient pain-free, make sure to repeat an EKG. Even if they never had pain in the emergency room, always make sure to get 2 EKGs on everyone you're going to admit for chest pain. And then you want to make sure to talk to a cardiologist, tell them up front the patient's age and their risk factors, whether or not they have coronary artery disease. Give a brief synopsis of their history. Make sure to let them know that their EKG, chest, X-ray, and cardiac enzymes are normal, that they got an aspirin, maybe if they got any nitro, and then that a repeat EKG is negative, and that you want to admit them for a low-risk rollout. So let's talk about pulmonary embolism. So classically in pulmonary embolism, we talk about this pleuritic chest pain. This is the chest pain all over the chest wall, and with associated shortness of breath, tachypnea, tachycardia, and hypoxia. So risk factors include for PE include OCPs, pregnancy, trauma, recent surgery, a suspicion for a DVT, and malignancy. Now, this doesn't mean that every female on birth control pills with chest pain gets a CT, although there are people that practice this way. One word of caution, without going into too much detail, let's say that the patient is on Coumadin with a therapeutic INR. So this is usually between 2 and 3. So if they're therapeutic on their INR, do they have a less risk of having a PE compared to someone who isn't anticoagulated? The answer, unfortunately, is no. This has been studied and has been shown that while you will get fewer DVTs and PEs over your lifetime with Coumadin, your overall risk of PE after walking through the door of an ED is no less likely than if you were therapeutically anticoagulated. This is one study that you may wish had never been done, but such is life. Bottom line, do not equate a therapeutic INR with protection from PE or DVT. So let's go through the basic workup for PE and how to get things done. First of all, you're going to get your EKG, your chest X-ray. You may want to get a PA in lateral if the patient is stable and they can handle going over to the radiology department. And then as far as labs, CBC, Chem-10, and COAGs. So as far as why you want that CBC, it's pretty low yield for us, but the admitting service is wanted, so I think it's pretty reasonable. A Chem-10, if you want another creatinine for a CT, radiology is going to require it. And then COAGs. If you have to anticoagulate the patient, you should have baseline COAGs on record before you anticoagulate them. So here comes the tricky part. This is probably one area in medicine that is the most controversial right now. I will tell you how I approach this, and I think this is how most attendings approach pulmonary embolism. I will warn you up front, do not indiscriminately order D-dimers on everyone whom you consider PE on. If you do, you're going to get lots of unnecessary CTs and expose a lot of patients to radiation unnecessarily. So first off, the first question you need to ask yourself is, what is your gestalt for the patient? What's your gut feeling? Are they low, medium, or high risk probability based on what you think? For example, the female with the tiniest bit of reproducible chest pain who isn't tachycardic probably doesn't have a PE. However, that pregnant patient who's coughing up blood, who's tachy, hypoxic, and tachypneic with a swollen right leg is probably pretty high risk. Medium is somewhere in between, and it's a real gray area. You have to consider their overall story and risk factors when deciding whether to go down this diagnostic route, and your attendings will have a better gestalt than you when you first start out. However, PE always needs to be on your differential for chest pain. So why do I make a big deal about your gut feeling? Because it allows us to use a clinical prediction rule to eliminate any further need for testing for pulmonary embolism. Up front, though, if your suspicion is moderate or high for pulmonary embolism, you need to get the CT to rule it out. The current state of practice is that you'll never be wrong to scan someone who's moderate or high risk without doing D-dimer first, although this may be changing in the future. The vast majority of patients who get PE workups fall into this low-risk category, and this is where you can avoid doing a CAT scan by using a clinical decision rule. I like the PERC rule. This stands for PE rule-out criteria. You first make the decision that the patient is low-risk based on your gut feeling. If they're medium or high-risk, stop there and order the CT. So if they're low-risk, see if they have any one of these six criteria. If they have any one of these six criteria, you cannot use this decision rule to say that they don't have pulmonary embolism. So the mnemonic for this is breaths, B-R-E-A-T-H-S. So the first one is B for blood in the sputum if they have hemoptysis. This is kind of a no-duh thing. Of course, you know, they're not low risk for PE if they have hemoptysis. R is for room air sat less than 95%. E is for estrogen or OCP use. Age is greater than 50 years old. T is for thrombosis in the past, PE or DVT, or the fact that you have a current clinical concern for a DVT. H is for heart rate greater than 100, so this is the thing that gets us the most because it's heart rate at any time documented at 100, whether it's in triage or in the back main emergency room. And S is for surgery in the last 4 weeks. So let's go over this one more time. Breaths, B is for blood and sputum, R is for room air sat, less than 95%. E is for estrogen or OCP use. A is for age greater than 50 years old. T is for thrombosis in the past, a PE or a DVT, or a current clinical concern for a DVT. H is for heart rate greater than 100, and S is for surgery in the past 4 weeks. What I recommend is if you have your little peripheral brains, the places you write things down on, is that you write down this decision rule so that you make sure you don't miss anything. So if they are low risk for PE and they have none of these six criteria, you stop there. You are done. You don't need a D-dimer. You don't need any further testing. So their risk of PE is not zero. It's 1.8%. However, 2% of people will be harmed by any coagulation that you give them for a PE, so that's why the 1.8% threshold is important, because in this situation, you're going to harm more people than you're helping by testing them, because 2% of people will be harmed by any coagulation, but their risk is only 1.8% for pulmonary embolism. So if you test people who are PERC negative, you're going to harm more people than you're going to help in the long run. And I think medical, legally, and current state of practice, this is an acceptable risk-benefit. However, if the patient is PERC positive, usually it's because they have a heart rate over 100 or they use OCPs, then most people will do what we call throw the D-dimer dice. This is the only time when you should get a D-dimer in a PE workup. It is very sensitive, 95% or greater, but not very specific. It's about 40% specific. So this means that if you apply it indiscriminately, you're going to give a lot of false positives and give a lot of people a lot of unnecessary CTs. So if you're PERC positive and the D-dimer is negative, then you stop. You and your patient won that dice throw and your patient doesn't need a CT. If the D-dimer is positive, then you've made a bad throw of the dice and they get a CTA for PE. This approach has not been backed up by current literature, but I think it's how most clinicians practice. I think most attendings will be impressed by this current way of thinking on working up pulmonary embolisms, so keep this in mind. So a quick word on PE treatment if you diagnose with someone with a PE. For patients with a small PE, this is called submassive, who don't have any vital signs, abnormalities, they should get treatment with Lovenox at 1 mg per kilogram sub-Q or heparin drip. If you have diagnosed their PE, you will look like a rock star if you add on cardiac enzymes and a BNP. If your cardiac enzymes or BNP are elevated, or you have an echo with RV strain, then this can be an indication for thrombolytics. These treatment recommendations are currently in flux, and I want to save that discussion for another time. If the patient is hemodynamically unstable, usually this is a systolic less than 90, then this is considered a massive pulmonary embolism and should get thrombolytics right away. So just to review, no vital sign changes, give Lovenox or heparin, and order the cardiac enzymes or BNP. If the cardiac enzymes or BNP are elevated, get your consultant on board and talk to them about the need for thrombolytics. If the patient is unstable in the emergency room with a diagnosed PE, then they need thrombolytics right away. So let's go over pulmonary embolism workup real quick. First of all, the thing that we talk about for pulmonary embolism is pleuritic chest pain with shortness of breath, tachycardia, risk factors, OCPs, pregnancy, trauma, recent surgery, or a suspicion for a DVT. Just because they're on Coumadin or anticoagulated doesn't mean that they couldn't possibly have a pulmonary embolism or a DVT as well. So your general workup, EKG, chest x-ray, CBC, Chem-10, and coags. The next thing to do is to risk stratify the patient. What's your gut feeling? Are they low risk, medium risk, or high risk? If they're medium or high risk, you should probably just proceed to a CAT scan and get that out of the way. If they are low risk, then you can use the PERC criteria, the breaths criteria, to determine whether you need to do any more testing. If they are PERC negative, they do not need any further testing. If they are PERC positive and you still have them in a low risk category, then you can do a D-dimer to try to avoid the need for a CAT scan. About 30% of the time, you're going to avoid that need for a CAT scan, but about 70% of the time, you're going to end up doing that CAT scan. If you diagnose someone with a pulmonary embolism and they are otherwise fine and they are stable hemodynamically, they can get Lovenox 1 mg per kilogram sub-Q or a heparin drip. From there, you should probably order a set of cardiac enzymes and a BNP. If they have an elevation of their cardiac enzymes or a BNP, or if they have an echo with RV strain, then this can be an indication for thrombolytics because they're actually straining their heart from the clot burden from their pulmonary embolism. If they're hemodynamically unstable, they're altered, or they have a systolic blood pressure less than 90, then they should get thrombolytics right away out of the emergency room. So this is how to work up chest pain in the ED in a nutshell, albeit a very large nutshell with lots of space to fill inside with other information. This is just a basic review that has really glossed over the subtleties of chest pain workups and shouldn't be the only source of your learning. What I suggest is to listen to this several times, read the summaries that are provided, and print out the summaries or write down the useful nuggets. Carry them around with you on shift and use them when you take care of patients. Better yet, go look up the PERC study and read it for yourself, or read the chapters in Rosenstern Analyses and see how this basic rapid review correlates with what's in the books. Until next time, this is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic Podcast, signing off.